Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Please welcome Garrison Keillor.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Here I am, O Lord, and here is my prayer. Please be there. Don't want to ask too much, miracles and such. Just whisper in the air, please be there. When I die like other folks, don't want to find out you're a hoax. So I'm not on my knees asking for world peace, or that the polar ice cap freeze and save the polar bear, or even that the poor be fed, or angels hover o'er my bed. But I would sure be pissed if I should have been an atheist. Oh, Lord, please exist, I'm a radio man for 35 years, doing an all-variety show based on some I used to hear when I was your age long ago. Critics pointed out my debts to Bob and Ray and Fibber McGee, but alcohol and cigarettes swept those critics out to sea. And to 20-year-olds who were born too late to hear the great Fred Allen, I'm the inventor of the form, sailing the airwaves like Magellan. A thief who escapes and is not hung may yet be honored by the young. Here beside the enormous swimming pool of the Hotel Biltmore, 26 young dark-skinned women lie in tiny bikinis like mermaids on the shore. And I, bound for Ithaca, just sail on by, looking for you, Penelope, to tell the tale how that whole Trojan War just gave me the willies. The pointlessness of it, so I set sail, having paid off Homer and left Achilles in his tent, and caught a favorable wind and stopped here at the Biltmore to recompute my route, and found 26 young dark-skinned women, their breasts displayed like fresh fruit. Thanks, but no thanks, they only want a tan. You, my dear, love a story, so I'm your man. Ooh, 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 I've been writing sonnets lately. Oh, which I love for the fact that they are 14 lines long. And so often 14 lines is about enough. Oh, 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 oh. You made crusty bread rolls filled with chunks of brie and minced garlic drizzled in olive oil and baked them until the brie was bubbly. And we ate them lovingly, our legs coiled together under the table, and salmon and dill with lemon and whole wheat couscous, baked with fresh ginger and garlic and a hill of green beans and carrots roasted with honey and tofu. It was beautiful, the candles, the linen, the silver, the sun shining down on our northern street. Me with my hand on your leg, you, my lover, in your jeans and green t-shirt and beautiful bare feet. How simple life is. We buy a fish, we are fed. We sit close to each other, we talk, and then we go to bed. Oh, 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 oh. Margaret was the smartest girl in the 11th grade. Tall with dark hair, tied up in a tight French braid. She was the only girl I knew who read Albert Camus. And for that very reason I did too. I stood behind her in choir, a lonely baritone. But when I smelled her exotic French cologne and felt the existential heat of her body, I became Luciano Pavarotti. In choir was where we met, I and the mysterious Margaret, the woman whom I adored. And as the choir sang praises to the Lord, I sang to the back of Margaret's head many things that could never be said. Whoa, 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 whoa. It's good to be here with you on this stage. Thank you so very much. It's always difficult in Los Angeles to tell which one you're supposed to sit on and which one is the end table. I'm here because I have committed another book. There are too many books in the world. I know this very well. And yet somehow it's difficult for me to stifle the urge to create yet another one. I apologize in advance for this. It's not that big a book. I mean, it's not enormous. It's not an enormous use of our country's woodland resources. I don't think it has in any way hindered your book from being published whenever it should be ready. So I only apologize up to a point, and not past that point. I've been writing since I was a small child, at first with a number two pencil on a big red Indian Chief pad, and I just have been unable to stop. I went into radio because it seemed to, you know, save on paper, and it was more sociable than writing. But somehow I keep going back to this, and this book is the third in a series of short comic novellas. The short comic novella is a form that disappeared with the death of P.G. Woodhouse, and so I'm trying to revive it, as I've been trying to revive the radio variety show. One of those hopeless missions that once you launch yourself on it, you will never lack for employment. because it can't be done. So I've set out to write short comic novellas, which is exactly the sort of book that the American people do not want. The American people are looking for tomes in which dark deeds are carried out by mysterious people in foreign cities. And I persist in writing short, lighthearted novellas. Although I must say that in the first of this series, a book called Pontoon, I killed off my main character in the very first sentence, which is kind of digs a hole for yourself. But I thought I carried that off pretty well. Her name was Evelyn, and that's the first line of the story. Evelyn Peterson died in her sleep, they said, though she was such an insomniac, you had to wonder about that. So it's a comic novella about a dead person, which is a nice challenge, and her death, of course, reveals the secrets of her life and her last wishes for her, for the disposal of her remains is what sets a story in motion. I followed this with a novel called Liberty, which is about a tremendously ambitious and capable and competent man in Lake Wobegon and the terrible price that he pays for this. He puts on a 4th of July parade, which is an enormous success, and gets the town exposure on CNN. And people just can never forgive him for it. And for putting on something that's really snazzy and really gorgeous, and so he goes off and he has a romance with a young woman whom he met in the parade. She was dressed as the Statue of Liberty, and she carried a torch and wore a five-pointed crown and an enormous sort of greenish, copperish colored robe, and while marching, she steps on the hem of her own robe and walks right up the inside of it. And that's when he falls in love. This book is about a pilgrimage, and it's called Pilgrims, and 12 people from Lake Wobegon, including somebody named Gary Keeler, host of a radio show, and a writer, go off to Rome. It's the idea of Margie Krebsbach, who is married to Carl Krebsbach, the town handyman and carpenter and builder, who gets a call one day at the high school where she teaches English from a woman in Rome, a woman named Maria, who's very curious about Lake Wobegon, and she's heard that there is a baseball team there made up of dogs. Dogs playing baseball. Well, no, not exactly. The nickname of the team is the Whippets, but they're actually men, and sometimes you wish they were dogs, but they're actually men. This intrigues her, and this woman's story, and. Margie Krebsbach is reading a memoir. Her book club is reading a memoir called O Paradiso by an Iowa farm woman, a former farm woman named Joanne. And Joanne was married to Earl, and Earl died a tragic death on his dairy farm in Iowa when he became furious at a Holstein who had just switched him in the face with its tail on which it had freshly defecated. Common occurrence, but he experienced barn rage, and And he hauled off, and he hit the Holstein as hard as he could, right in the forehead, in the bony part of the head, which didn't hurt the cow at all, but it sort of changed her attitude, and she was laying for him after that, and he sensed that she was spreading discord in the herd. And when he went down for the early morning milking at a god-awful hour, there they all were, their rumps lined up along the alley as he walked along, and enormous quantities of cow flop were excreted in his direction, and tails waved at him. And it just took all of the joy out of dairy farming. And it was terrible anxiety on his part, and he suffered a heart attack, and he fell down there. Joanne was there to catch him, and she dialed 911, which, when you live on a dairy farm, takes a long time for them to come. You have to remember that if you should decide to move to Iowa. And she held his head in her arms, and as she did, she thought, I've got to get out of here. And she wanted to sell the dairy farm and move to Italy to discover the meaning of life and the joy of life and to discover how to really enjoy things, which we were brought up not to do in the Midwest, and felt that we would be punished if we actually did experience pleasure, actual pleasure, not a sort of, you know, simulacrum of pleasure, but real pleasure. And so she wants to go off to Italy where she can learn how to dance out in public with her hands up over her head and to sing and to drink wine and in the morning and have a big time. So he dies and she sells the farm in a scandalously short period of time. And she heads off to Rome, where in no time this Iowa farm woman who has plowed driveways, has castrated pigs, has brought up three children and taught them algebra, who has delivered calves, and which required her to stick her arm up to the shoulder into a cow, and she said this earthy Iowa farm life, and now she's on the Via Veneto in Rome, and she's drinking powerful coffee late at night in a little sidewalk restaurant, and she's talking about the meaning of life with a woman whom she met in the life drawing class, where they sketched men in the nude. Charcoal on paper. Well, it was quite a book, O Paradiso. And some of the members of Margie Krebsbach's book club felt that it was a real testament of liberation, and others felt that this was shameful. And what if everyone did that? Where would we all be? Well, in Rome. And it would be a very different city with all of us there. But this became a sort of a guide for Margie Krebsbach after her husband Carl, who finds himself suddenly in deep water financially because someone has reneged on payments on a house that he's agreed to build for him, this stockbroker from Minneapolis. He stops sleeping with her, and she doesn't know what to do about it. And a trip seems to be the only answer. You can't solve your problems by talking about them. You just have to change the scene. You just have to change the subject and get out of here. It really troubles her. This happens on a January night. And he's watching television in the living room, Carl is, and it's a basketball game, and Minnesota's getting pounded, and then he switches to a documentary about the Inuit, And then to some sort of comedy in which people say cruel things and other people laugh. And meanwhile, she's on the phone with her mother down in Tampa, who's worried about her father, Mr. Schoenecker, who is 86 years old but is losing his grip and has just bought a brand new Buick and the extended warranty. And and who is all fussed up over Obama's inauguration, this man who never took an interest in politics before. And now he's reading the paper every morning and saying, when will this country wake up? And he's afraid that Obama is going to bring about same-sex marriage, and he's going to tax the pants office, and he's going to bring this country down. He buys a dog, an enormous big black Labrador called Rush, which is too big for him. Drags the poor old geezer through parking lots. His elbows are all skinned up. He's gone mad, and Margie's trying to deal with this, and she can hear Carl going up the stairs as she's telling Mama he's got to have his lithium every day at the same time, and you've got to get rid of that dog, and maybe you need to come back here until he settles down. And she can hear Carl going down the hall, down to where their daughter Carla used to sleep. Before she moved away, married the chiropractor in Palm Springs, she used to sleep down in that bedroom. And Carl has ensconced himself up there. And by the time Margie has let the cats out, Boo Boo and Mr. Peepers, and they have walked archly through the deep snowdrifts, and they've found a bare place in which to pee, and they've come back in. The light is out in that bedroom, which is now their guest room, used to be Carla's room, and he's sleeping in that bed with the muslin canopy over it and the Martina Navratilova poster on the wall. Why? She doesn't know why. Are you okay? She says, Are you okay? He says, yeah, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. Why are you sleeping? Well, because I wanted to read. He says, the light's out. I didn't want to keep you awake. Well, this is crazy. This is just crazy. He's been reading in her bed for 35 years now, and she's gone to sleep. He lies there and he reads everything ever written about the Battle of Gettysburg, and over and over, in Chancellorsville and Antietam. He reads Civil War history and lies there completely soaked up in it so that she can say, and she said to him, just to see if he's cognizant, she said, I think I'm really Buddhist. He said. Yeah. I think I'm going to move to Nepal. I'm going to change my name to Joy. Joyful anticipation. And I think I found this guy in a Buddhist class, and he's going to come with me. He's been reading for years. What's different now? She doesn't know. She can't understand this. But she doesn't want to ask him what's wrong, because he'll say nothing. Nothing's wrong. I'm fine. I'm fine. Why do you ask? Why are you sleeping here? He just wants her to wonder, and then he'll maybe tell her something, but she doesn't want to get into it. She just doesn't want to get into it. And now weeks have passed, and silence, and he's gone. He's gone, and she misses him. And it's not about sex so much, necessarily. It's just about having him next to her in bed, and having him lying there in the trough where he's been lying all of these years, like a stanchion. There he is, reading his book about Antietam, and she can always turn to him and say, rub my back. And so He will, and he'll rub it always clockwise, always clockwise. And if he gets interested, which he may, you never know, he may slip his left arm under her head, and now he'll put the book away, and now this hand will slip around and rub her belly. And then maybe his right leg will come up over her right leg. It proceeds in steps. And these steps have always been the same. And the possibility that it might happen is good enough. Even if it doesn't happen for weeks, the possibility of it is good enough. Just to have him there. She misses him. And to bring him back, she finds a reason to go to Rome. You have to have a reason. You can't just go. We take trips in Lake Wobegon to visit our relatives. This is the primary reason. If there's a relative in need, a child who has just had your grandchild, here's a perfect reason to travel. We don't just go to look at things. There has to be some purpose. She finds that there's an American from Lake Wobegon, a young man named Gussie Norlander, who died in the liberation of Rome in May of 1944. And his mother, her dying wish was that someone should go over and see the grave where he lies and affix a picture of Gussie to the tombstone so that people will know that a particular person is lying there and not just a name and a serial number, but a real person is down there in the ground, an American boy who had long blonde hair that always fell down into his forehead and who had that goofy grin. So we all go. I go with them. I go down to the airport in Minneapolis with these 11 pilgrims from Lake Wobegon. I walk up to gate G8, and I have my ticket in my pocket in seat 3B. Got a lot of mileage. I've upgraded. And Irene Bunsen walks up to me and snatches the ticket out of my pocket and says, "I think Lyle should use your ticket. Lyle has just been diagnosed as being in the opening stages of Alzheimer's. And so this may be his last trip as himself." Lyle Jansky, the retired biology teacher from Lake Wobegon High School. And she hands me his ticket in 38J. I think that somebody who's coming down with Alzheimer's is less likely to appreciate being up in first class, but she thinks that he should have this, that he should be able to have the lamb cutlets and the tossed salad and the shrimp cocktail and the glass of Pinot Noir and the German chocolate cake. And I can have whatever they serve back in steerage. She has always had it in for me, this woman, Irene Bunsen. And then she sees that I have a notebook in my pocket and she reaches for it and she snatches it and she sees this story that I have just started to write called Vaney V.D. Vicky, about a writer going over to Rome, and he has a radio show and he's also a novelist, and he goes over there and meets this beautiful young woman who has gone to Rome in search of herself, though she's from California. And she discovers that although he is in radio and an older man, he has terrific abdominals, and he And he is a fabulous dancer and a very imaginative and generous lover. I'm sure she'll discover that later. But he takes her out dancing and says profound, "You're not going to write about this," says Irene Bunsen. "You're not going to write down things that we say, are you?" I say, "Of course I am. I'm a writer. I'm a writer. I invented you. I invented this whole town. This..." "Of course I am." "But I am among people who do not like me because they grew up with me. And they remember me at my worst, when I was tall and ungainly and self-conscious, and when I walked up to Irene Bunsen on an April night and we sat down under a dying oak tree outside the high school, and I said, 'Do you ever think that life is just a dream, that we're just dreaming all of this? And am I in your dream or are you in mine? Or perhaps both might be true. But if you woke up, then what would happen to me? Would I then cease to exist, or would I then live in somebody else's dream, or what?'" She looked at me as if I were demented. I just thought it was an interesting question somehow. I was at that stage. I was tall and ungainly. I came from a poor family. I was the third child in a family of six. I wore hand-me-down clothes, mostly from my older brother, some from my older sister. Jeans that zipped up the side. A white shirt with decorative stuff up above and yokes on the side, so that when you walked down the hall in school, you had to hold your books in a strategic way. It was a rough way to grow up. And then I went off and I started this radio show, and I became somebody unlike the person they had known in Lake Wobegon. And so they looked on me as a fake. I, who had created them, after all. It was an awkward place for me to be. But there I had a ticket for 38J, and I head down the aisle, way, way to the back of the plane, way back there. And as I walked towards 38J, a woman stood up who had a big smile on her face, and she said, "Bob, it's the man from the radio." She was sitting in 38I. He was sitting in 38K. For some reason, they didn't want to change seats with me. She said, "I've been listening to you since I was a small child." She didn't look that young. She said, "I know you better than people I'm directly related to. Isn't that something? I know all about you. I've listened to your show forever. I mean, my own brothers, I don't know what their sexual fantasies are, but I know what yours are. Because I've listened to your stories, and I know about your feelings of inferiority and your self-consciousness because your wrists are so thin, and how you're always the last chosen for softball teams, and you're always put out into right field, and I know all about that, and all about your fear of spiders and your fear of thunderstorms and all the rest, and your dream, this persistent nightmare that you have, in which you are being chased by tall men with black masks through tall bougie grass towards the edge of a precipice. And you're going towards the edge of the precipice, and beyond you can hear the surf breaking on jagged rocks and shark-infested waters, and black birds are circling and circling overhead. I know all about this. You know, she said, "We've got a 9-hour flight ahead of us. We could take up some of these issues. I'm a therapist. I work with these things. Well, that's sort of what this story is about. They go off to Rome with me in tow, and they're pilgrims. They're off on a mission, but their true mission is something other than anything they're able to enunciate. The third book in a series of comic novellas. The first one is the one I'm particularly fond of, Pontoon, because it came out on September the 10th, 2001. I went to New York for the debut, which was at the Barnes & Noble down in Union Square, and it was a lovely audience. We were way up, I think on the fifth floor, and the lights of Union Square were behind me, and I read from this book, and afterwards some old friends from the New Yorker and I went out for dinner at a little seafood restaurant just a little downtown from there, and there were the Twin Towers standing ghostly in the distance. We had this wonderful, wonderful late supper on a warm fall night in New York, and I walked over to 7th Avenue and I took the subway uptown to my apartment on the Upper West Side, and woke up in the morning and this amazing low-flying jet plane was coming down the Hudson River and just a block away from my apartment. I'd never heard a plane flying that low. So I'm fond of that book. It came out at an impossible time. It was the worst possible time to publish a work of comic fiction. And because it was a hopeless situation, I've always been fond of that book, deeply fond of it. Later, years, actually 2 years, three years later, a woman came up to me at a reading in Connecticut, and she had four of my books in hand, four of the early books in hand, and she started to hand them to me and wanted me to sign them for her brother, and then she started to cry. Her brother had been killed in one of the towers, I forget which one. He worked for that brokerage firm that was way up high in the sky. He was from New Jersey, and she wanted me to sign these books in his memory, and I was able to give her a copy of the book Pontoon, which I assumed she had missed out on since it came out at such an unlikely time. My book, in which I killed off my main character at the very beginning of the story, just to see if it could be done, you know. You want to set yourself a little challenge for yourself. This tall, rangy woman of Lake Wobegon, Esther Peterson, so independent. My aunt, I say, in the book, though she was really based on a couple of cousins who now are the age that my aunt would be if I were much younger. You can get away with this in fiction. Who had been liberated by the death of her own husband, my Uncle Jack, a dark Norwegian who married her in 1942. He was in training for the Navy in Chicago and convinced her that he was going to die in the war. He was going to go down with a ship. He was a defeatist. Had a dark imagination, and he convinced her that she should offer comfort to an American fighting man who was just about to perish for his country. And in those days, and to my people, offering comfort meant that you had to get married first. So they did. They married, and she was comforting to him for a few weeks, and then he went off into the service. And to her surprise, he came back. And then the real wars began. They had three children together, and a kind of a rocky life in Lake Wobegon, until finally she had to kick him out because he had developed a major hobby of Jim Beam bourbon, and she couldn't bear that any longer. So she sent him into exile in the hunting shack off on the far side of Lake Wobegon, out beyond the Muskeg, out where the Norwegian bachelor farmers live, out where we used to go camping when I was in Boy Scouts. On January nights, we would pitch our frozen canvas tents out there, because suffering is good for you. That's what I was brought up to believe, and it may well be true. How would I know? He went to live out there, my Uncle Jack, this man who medicated himself heavily every day, had this horrible purple nose, who nonetheless I was fond of. He was a heavyset man. He was bald with a fringe, a sort of a tonsure around his head. He had a little mustache that got raggedy in his later years. He was a drunk and embarrassing to my family, but he was sweet to children, and for that you could forgive him a great deal. He took me fishing one summer morning. This would have been in June. Early in the morning, it must have been 3:30 or 4 in the morning. Still, the sun had not come up yet. I would have been about 12 or 13 years old. I didn't realize at the time that this was the end of his day, not the beginning of it. But I was there. I'd set my alarm clock. I came down to the end of the driveway. He drove me down to the lake, and we hauled his green rowboat out of the weeds, and we washed it, sluiced it out in the lake. It had been used for a long time. He had a bait bucket and two rods and a thermos, and we got into the boat and we shoved off. There were mists out over the water early in the morning. It was so beautiful and mysterious as the sun came up. Mists on the water, so you could not see the other shore. You might as well have been on the North Atlantic. You were out on the ocean. You were in the book of Genesis at the creation of the world. It was so, so beautiful, beyond anything I'd known except in stories. It was like a story come to life. My uncle sat in the stern, and the boat pointed up a little bit. He let me row. He was incapable, I guess. I rowed out into the mists, and I could smell his coffee, and I could smell the flavoring that he poured into his coffee, and I could smell his cigar. Even today, if I smell a cheap cigar, it brings back some of that summer morning to me and my uncle. We put the worms on our hooks. I lowered my worm into the water. He sat. He drank his coffee. We looked out into the mists. And he said, "It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden had but only one wish, was to love and be loved by me. I was a child and she was a child in that kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was greater than many far older than we, than many far wiser than we. Until a wind came out of a cloud, killing and chilling my Annabel Lee. The angels in heaven were jealous of her and me, and that was the reason as all men know in that kingdom by the sea, a wind came out of a cloud, killing my Annabel Lee, so that her high-born kinsman came and bore her away from me and shut her up in a sepulchre in a tomb by the sounding sea. But neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. For the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee, and the stars do not shine, but I see the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. So every night I lay down by the side of my darling, my love and my bride, in her tomb by the bounding sea. He recited the whole poem to me, and even more accurately than I just did it for you. And then we went back to the dock and we pulled up alongside. I stepped out onto the dock and carried the poles and the bait bucket, and I was supposed to have tied the boat to the dock, but forgot. And my uncle, who was two sheets to the wind, came walking from the stern down the beam of the boat to the middle seat, and then took the long step to the dock as the boat slowly drifted away. And he hung there in the air like a great planet, like a constellation. And then gracefully fell into water up to his armpits and didn't cry out, didn't curse me, just waded into shore and took off his pants and his shirt and wrung them out and put them back on and looked at me. And he said, well, he said, you shouldn't ever go fishing if you don't dare get wet. Good advice. Good advice for life. Now I'm telling you all of this, and I can't even remember if I put any of this in that book or not. I just can't. I can't remember if I remember to pay homage to my uncle in this book, which is mostly about Aunt Evelyn and her romance that she carried on after Uncle Jack left us. He was an embarrassment, but you know, to find love in your heart, true love for a sinner, is such a revelation to a boy brought up as I was by righteous people. To truly love a sinner was the beginning of knowledge for me. Easy to love for the righteous. But here was a man who was an embarrassment, who went into the sidetrack tap. Nobody in our family went into the sidetrack tap. This was a place that smelled terrible, terrible smells in there. Beer and smoke and vomit. And you just didn't want to be part of that at all. We weren't drinkers in our family. But he saved my life once, you see. I'd gone camping. Einar, our scoutmaster, took us up to out there in the muskeg, in the frozen muskeg beyond the birch trees and beyond the lake. We went the coldest night in January, 40 below zero, and in my town the outside thermometers only went down to 40 below. Colder than that you just didn't even want to know about, so it may very well have been 60 below. We didn't figure wind chill back then. It just didn't even want to know, get into that, because it would terrify you, and you'd no longer be able to live in Minnesota if you knew how cold it actually was. So 40 below, that we were satisfied with that. These were different times back then. We did not have weather forecasting. There was no weather radar. Radar was used to defend our country against the perfidious Soviets. And we just lived with the knowledge that another storm was coming pretty soon. There was no forecasting. There was just a sense of dread. Some old person sitting in a chimney corner wrapped in a tattered quilt, some old person who you weren't even sure how they were related to you, but they were sitting there in sort of toothless grin and chicken fat dribbling down their grizzled chin, and they were listening to the wind in the chimney, and they were saying things, "It's going to be a bad one. Oh, it's going to be a bad one. The judgment of the Lord cannot be withstood, no." And so then the next storm would come down from Canada, come rolling down from Saskatchewan. No windbreak, just barbed wire. And yet we always went off to school. You went off to school no matter what. School was never canceled in Minnesota. Once you start canceling school, where would you stop? So... you just went. You just bundled yourself up in heavy clothing. There's no lightweight thermal wear back then. That came along with the space program. We just wore heavy corduroys and woolens, layers and layers. You kept warm by the exertion of carrying heavy clothing. little 80-pound child carrying 40 pounds of clothing on you. On your back, little Sherpa going out the door into the blizzard, out into this blinding blizzard. They strung a clothesline from the front of the house out to the mailbox, and then up to the county road where the bus would come or the something would come, and pick you up and take you off to school. You walked unable to see anything. You could hear carnivorous animals around you. In the blizzard, but you were helpless. You were helpless walking in these heavy clothes and big four buckle overshoes and enormous icicles hanging from the limbs of trees like swords over your head. And now you understood why your parents had extra children. No small families, you know. And probably you were one of the extras. So you went up to the road where you had built a snow fort, and the girls huddled inside it. They pulled their skirts down over their bare legs, and they put their lipstick on there in the cold. They came from Christian families, so they weren't allowed to wear lipstick, but they brought it with them anyway. And we boys protected them. We stood around the snow forth, this high wall, and we protected them against coyotes and wolves by every morning creating a fresh ring of yellow snow around We went camping. Einar, our scoutmaster, who was a Norwegian, and so he was impervious to pain himself, he had no sensations. He tried to teach us all sorts of survival skills, which we tried to learn. But Einar, when he spoke, he had ropey spit, and so you became fascinated just looking in his mouth as he explained how to tie the bowline hitch, which was the knot that you would tie a rope around you when a rope was tossed to you. If you were deep down in a bear trap, for example, and rescuers came there tossing, you'd tie the bowline hitch, and the rabbit would come out of the hole and around the tree and go back down the hole. But you were fascinated by the pattern of spit in Einar's mouth and stalactites and stalagmites of saliva that were formed there between his teeth. And so I can't remember how to tie a bowline hitch. And very little else that he tried to teach me that I have any recollection of. But I do remember that night when we camped, built a big bonfire, 40 below zero or more, and roasted our supper in tinfoil in the hot coals of this bonfire. Boys freezing, and the wall tent there, and our sleeping bags, no down sleeping bags, just army blankets that were sewn together with heavy waxed twine. And you just dove into this big pile of boys just huddled close together like sled dogs all piled in there together. And you survived that way, or you hoped you would survive. I woke up at 2 or 3 in the morning in this bluish moonlight, billows of breath coming out of your mouth, just the coldest I've ever been in my life, and having to pee so badly. Lying there in a heap of boys, warm, sort of thinking over your options. If you did, would they know it was you? But you extricate yourself from this pile and from this warmth, and you go out through the flaps and out into this moonscape, this unbelievable landscape, which just says death, 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 death. And you walk down through the birch trees and out into the muskeg and down this ravine, because you come from a family of modest people. And you don't want anybody to see you do this, although if the truth be told, when it's that cold, there's not much to be seen. You go off down a ravine and then over the rise and down through these other trees, and now you can't bear it any longer. When you're that age, you have a bladder of steel, but nonetheless, there are limits, and you unzip, and you've managed to find it somehow. It sort of has retracted up into your body, and it's up next to your pancreas somewhere. And you get it out, and this unbelievable, powerful stream comes out of you, and it shoots 12 feet out into the dark. It's steaming hot when it comes out of you, and you can hear it hit the ground. It's frozen when it hits the ground. It's little chips of ice falling like somebody dropped a handful of dimes on the frozen tundra. And then you start to think about how far up the arc the ice might come. It's a serious moment. And in all of this, I forgot which way I had come from. And I just couldn't tell. And I when I had finished, I went off and it didn't seem to be there. I couldn't see Einar's truck. I couldn't see a tent. I couldn't see the last glow of a campfire. I went off in the other direction. And now I was hopelessly lost. I was brought up by people who believed in the imminence of death, and now here it was. And I was prepared to die and was sort of going over in my own mind what my last minutes would be like. And I heard my uncle singing. I could hear his voice coming. He was skiing home from the sidetrack tap in town where he'd been, and he was wildly drunk. And he was singing, "Roll me over in the clover, roll me over, lay me down and do it again. Hey, hey, roll me over in the clover." To be saved by a drunk, to be saved by an old reprobate and a singer, who on the coldest night of winter is singing a song about fornication is a miraculous event. I keep going back to that day and wonder how that set me on my course and made me into the amiable sinner that I am today. I will never know the whole story because my uncle died just about a year after that. He died as I had seen him that night. He was drunk. He was going into town to the sidetrack tap to refresh himself, and he was in bad shape. He was walking up the street towards the sidetrack tap on a bitterly cold day the following January, and he saw his nemesis, Mr. Berge, coming down the street towards him, this old Norwegian. The two of them had had an argument since they were children about the authenticity of the Kensington runestone, which was a stone that was found in a cornfield in western Minnesota in the late 1880s by a farmer, and it had runic writings on it, Norwegian runic writings from an ancient language, and it purported to be the stone left there by Viking explorers in the year 1220. And the inscription said that we have come from Vinland and we are not feeling well, and so we are going back. Well, some people felt that this demonstrated that the Vikings were such amazing navigators that they were able to find their way all the way to the middle of North America and leave this stone and go back. Mr. Berge believed in the authenticity of it. My Uncle Jack felt that anybody with the IQ of a potted plant would know that this was a fake, that you wouldn't leave stone in a language that nobody would understand out here in the middle of Aboriginal America. This was the work of some old soybean farmer with time on his hands. They carried on this argument, and they never really bothered to argue the merits of the case. They just started yelling at each other insults whenever they saw each other, of which there are a great many in Norwegian. It is a language which is rich with scorn. My uncle was yelling at Mr. Berge when he felt this pain in his chest, and he grabbed hold of the parking meter. There's just one in town. It's right there in front of the sidetrack tap. The town council put it up as an experiment in the early 50s, and nobody put any money into it. And if you couldn't even get drunks to do that, then who else is going to? So they never put up any more. He grabbed hold of this parking meter, and his last words on earth were, "You've got shit for brains." And down he went. He fell down on the ice, on a sheet of ice on the sidewalk, fell down. Mr. Berge looked down at him and he said, "You go to hell." Then he saw that might be the case, and he ran into the sidetrack tap, and he called the constables, Gary and Leroy, and they came, and they called the sheriff, and the sheriff came and called the ambulance, and the ambulance called the coroner, and somehow the fire department got out there. And so you had yellow ribbon around my uncle's body lying there, and you had walkie-talkies, and you had squawk boxes going off, and you had flashing red and yellow and blue lights. And it was a big, big scene, the very sort of a scene that my uncle dearly, dearly loved, any sort of emergency, he was always present. So it was a shame that he should miss this and to miss it by just 10 minutes. Now I just can't remember if I put him in the book or not, and it really bothers me. Well, that's why you do a radio show. That's why you tell stories about these people. You lightly disguise them and you put them into an imaginary town, so that you can keep them alive in hopes that someday you might be able to get to the bottom of it. Time is running out, but I haven't given up yet. Are there any questions from this fine audience? Anything that you need to know? I see somebody. Okay. There was a microphone set up somewhere. And, you don't need a microphone. Talk to me. You have a microphone.
Here's the microphone.
Oh, there is.
And there's
okay.
One over there.
Oh, good. Okay. And there's one over there, too. All right. Any questions from this? Yes, right here. No? Oh, I'm sorry. Someone was just standing up to leave, and I've embarrassed him. I'm sorry? Yes, that way. This way. Oh, right here. Oh, yes, of course. How are you?
Any jokes you can share with us?
Any jokes at all? I thought I had just told a number of them. Those were not jokes? Oh, you mean like jokes? Oh, something from the upcoming joke show. I didn't know there was an upcoming joke show. But if there is one, I'll get them to you promptly. Yes.
What really inspired you to start the Prairie Home Companion and the whole show in general?
I'm sorry.
How did it start? Like, period.
Oh, the radio show.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I mean, everybody has to have something, you know. Everybody has to be somewhere. I was 32. And I had just written an article for the New Yorker magazine about the Grand Ole Opry down in Nashville, Tennessee, which was moving from its home in the Ryman Auditorium in a seedy section of the city out to a big new place in the suburbs. And so I went to write about that in 1974. It was, you know, during the Watergate episode, and they just seemed to be having a good time. I'd been in radio for years. It was the only way an English major could earn a living, and was by impersonating a sort of a ponderous gentility. And these people seemed to be having more fun than I had ever had in radio before, and they were country music stars, and Cousin Minnie Pearl was there, and Dolly Parton was there, and Loretta Lynn, and these old fiddlers, and Roy Acuff, and Chet Atkins, and they just seemed to be having a good time, and I wanted to have a good time too. So that's why I did that, and that's why I still do it. I'm still looking to have a good time. Some of us. Yes,
I had a question. I wondered if you might have any wise words to bring us from Lake Wobegon, where apparently all the women are beautiful and all the children are above average. C- how can we, have you any wise words, lessons from Lake Word Be Gone about how they handle all the children being above average?
Well, I think that they believe in a degree of neglect, and they believe in letting the children wander around and bump into things, and get into trouble. I think that our children, mine anyway, and the children of people whom I know in St. Paul, Minnesota, suffer from much too much attention from adults. There are so many books written about child rearing, and it encourages a sort of obsessiveness on the part of parents, which is very hard on parents. I see marriages that languish because people are completely absorbed in the lives of their children. No parent should ever go to a child's sporting event, ever. See, in Lake Wobegon, they don't do that. We don't do that. You go off and you read interesting books and you talk about scandalous things with other grown-ups, and your children go off and play their sports and do whatever they do, and you just simply ignore them, and they are brought up by other children, and other children do this pretty well. Someday somebody will do some research on this, and show that in larger families, the early children who had all of the benefits of the parenting skills that the parents had picked up from the reams of books they had read, the early children did not do as well as the younger children who grew up with neglect and ignorance. and then maybe things will change. Parents are supposed to amuse each other, and they're supposed to enjoy each other, and children are supposed to let them do that. Parents are supposed to have a life.
I think
yes,
I'm next.
Yes.
I've been listening to Prairie Home Companion since they started broadcasting it in Los Angeles on KUSC,
yes,
which is a long time ago.
Yes.
And every week you tell these incredible stories about Lake Wobegon.
Mm.
It's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon. Mm. I've never heard you repeat a story. How much of them do you start off knowing in advance what you're going to say? And how much of it do you make up as you go along?
Well, sometimes you're going to be surprised, and when you launch into a story, and you do want to retain a certain liberty for yourself. There have been stories in which I stuck to what I had thought I was going to say, and I really regretted it. There was a story I told once in which it was an interesting premise for a story, but a man had taken a calf into his house, and he lived alone, and so it didn't really matter. And he raised this calf in an upstairs bedroom, and then he had to get it out of the house, and it was terrified of the stairs, and he had to bring it downstairs. I knew as I was laying the foundation of this story that I shouldn't go where I had planned to go, which was to slaughter the cow. It's what my people would have done. But they would have done it privately, and they wouldn't have told anybody about it. I had to do it. I did it in the story, and I knew the moment I did it, it was the wrong thing. There are people who cannot forget that scene. I skipped over it as lightly as I could, but you owe people some details. And it was just absolutely dreadful. And there were probably children who heard that, who were deeply affected and have been affected ever since. So you want to retain some freedom so that you can save yourself from yourself in the course of telling a story. You don't want to get in too deep. Yes. Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Keeler. Would you comment, is there any significance to the Red Sox trademark? And what music do you listen to?
The Red Sox are just a habit. They're just a habit. They're the only socks that I have. I used to wear black socks, but for black socks, you needed black shoes. And I just came to a point where I'd had enough with black. And so I just stepped away from it. And this is where I am. I don't even notice them, you know. I don't look down at my feet all that much. So it's just a little bit of color, you know, among the male of the species. And whatever that's for, I'm not sure. And the other part of your question was,
what music do you listen to?
What music do I listen to? I listen to myself singing duets with whatever women I can find who are interested in singing with me. I love to sing with people. Sometimes my sister will come over. And we will sing the hymns of our childhood. And other times, my friend Andrew Suki will come over, and we'll sing all the country western songs that we know. That's the music that I listen to. Sometimes I listen to my daughter who walks around the house singing songs from Mamma Mia. But I stopped listening to recorded music a long time ago. I just think that music is so miraculous that I can't imagine walking around with it in my ears. I don't object to anybody else doing it. But I just can't imagine doing it myself. I want to hear traffic, and I want to hear people's voices, and then when I go and hear an opera,
wow!
It's like you've come in from the woods, you know, and this is the first decent meal you've had in a long time. It's just so gorgeous, so gorgeous. You can wear out your ears listening to too much, so. I don't listen to the radio, I have to admit. It's for other people. Yes. Another question, one more from this side? Anything I can tell you? Oh.
A few years ago, you left the show briefly.
This is many years ago.
Yes. Yes. And you went to Norway?
I went to Denmark, yes.
Denmark, yeah.
Denmark.
Did that
Denmark
change?
Denmark was Norway's oppressor at one time, but...
Okay. Did that experience change any of your humor, your writing? Because it was a sabbatical. I was afraid you were coming back to the show, and I'm just wondering what that was all about.
No, it was just an enormous wrong turn. It was an enormous wrong turn carried out by a 45-year-old man who thought that he was going to go off and write a serious novel, and I got over it. When you make a bad wrong turn in your life, you know, you start to get inklings of it almost right away. And I sat in my room in Copenhagen. I lived in an apartment on Trepkaskade, and from my room that I wrote in, I could see the gates of the Soviet embassy, and I could see how buttoned up and how furtive and how threatening it looked, and the men in those strange military uniforms of the Soviet Union marching up and down, and huge gates and barriers, you know, against trucks trying to crash it and so forth. And I felt like a prisoner in my own little writing room, a prisoner to a novel that I did not want to write. And I couldn't quit it soon enough. I made a valiant attempt to become Danish. I did my very, very best. I became Danish sort of to the point of a not terribly bright 10-year-old. And I thought, it's time to go back to English, really. That's your language, and that's your culture, and you've got more work to do. So I managed to finagle my way back to New York and start up the show again, and gradually bring it back. It took me a long time to correct a wrong turn.
We're glad you came back.
Well. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Yes.
One last question.
When you were a young kid, I think I read somewhere that you were afraid to become an ordinary person. When you reflect back on your life, are you that ordinary person? And are you okay with that? Or you want it to be different from the rest of them?
Well, that's a terrific question. When I was in the eighth grade, I started to write poetry in a school that was devoted to football, and so I felt odd, which was thrilling and at the same time uncomfortable to me. But I couldn't play football, because I had this little congenital heart condition. And so if you can't be that, then you should be something entirely other and not sit around wishing that you could play football. When I was born, my name was Gary, G-A-R-Y, and my family calls me Gary because that's my name. I gave myself the name Garrison when I was in the eighth grade as a pen name. And because it sounded, it was sort of a defense, because I was writing poetry and not very good poetry. So I gave myself that name, and I've now lived most of my life as Garrison Keillor. But somewhere there's a Gary Keillor, and I often wonder about him and what may have become of him. I don't have any desire. I'm not dissatisfied with my life at all. I feel extremely, extremely lucky. But I do wonder about him sometimes. And there are cousins of mine who I feel know what happened to him, and they haven't let me in on this. The end of the story, though, is that when you are so lucky to be able to do what you most love to do, and to write and to do a radio show. All English majors want to be singers. When you're so lucky to be able to do this, then what you discover is the ordinariness of it, the ordinary hard work of constructing paragraphs, which is over-dramatized by writers as being some kind of tragic struggle. It's not. It's just hard work. It's more like dentistry than it is anything else. It's more like what my father did. My father was a carpenter, and he put up
he put up sheetrock, and he painted it, and he redid people's homes, and he fixed roofs. What I do is carpentry, essentially, and I'm very lucky to have the work, and lucky for all of you to come. Thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.